It's been a number of years ago. Well, it was back when I was a teenager, so it's been quite a long time. There was a popular comedian by the name of Flip Wilson, and one of his famous characters was a preacher who preached for what he called the What's Happening Now church. And in one of the skits that Flip Wilson did, he, as the preacher, shouted to the congregation that if this church is going to serve God, then it's got to get down on its knees and crawl. And the congregation shouts back, "Make it crawl, preacher, make it crawl." The preacher continued, and once this church has learned to crawl, it needs to get up on its feet and to walk. And the congregation shouts back, "Make it walk, preacher, make it walk." And once it's learned to walk, it needs to learn to begin to run. And make it run, preacher, make it run. And then the preacher shouted, "And in order to run, it's got to reach deep down into its pockets and learn to give." And after a long pause, the congregation responds, "Make it crawl, preacher, make it crawl." Christianity is expensive, isn't it? I think that's one of the reasons why unbelievers have such a hard time figuring out the lifestyle of those who are disciples of Jesus. It's quite understandable. They are guided in life by a philosophy that promotes self. You look out for number one, that promotes greed. You take whatever you can get, that assigns value in terms of dollars and cents. And when you're guided by that kind of thinking, then those who view life as from the or pursue life with a perspective of selflessness and generosity appear to be weak saps. Because after all, why would anyone deny themselves any pleasure in life when life is so short? Why would people whose lives are at least as busy as the unbeliever's life, why would they carve out time each week on a Sunday or for worship, or on a Wednesday night for Bible study? Why would they take time out of their week to serve others? Things that did absolutely nothing to advance their careers or to promote their own self-centered agendas. And why would people who are already carrying their load as tax-paying citizens give even more of their income to the Lord? And if we were asked to explain our actions in those elements, we might simply tell them that the reason that we do all of those things is out of our love for the one who first loved us. That God and His Son not only have done so much already in the past, but they continue to do, to give so much in the present, and they promise to do more in the future, and therefore in response we can only give more and more of ourselves. That because of our increasing love for God, there is nothing that we would not do for Him, that He truly is our everything. The death of Jesus on the cross, one of the most well-known stories in all of the world, and among its cast of characters there are the very familiar names like Judas and Peter and Pontius Pilate and the high priest of the time, Caiaphas. But the scene leading up to the cross is also punctuated by a number of rather unlikely characters. For example, there are a couple of Simons that are mentioned. One is a leper who is invited to invites Jesus to a meal, it seems, in his home that we'll look at this morning. There is another Simon from Cyrene who will be called upon to carry the cross of Jesus. There will be an unnamed centurion who will be the first one following the death of Jesus to give voice to the truth of Jesus being the Son of God. There will be a largely anonymous group of women who will sometimes do more to embody the teaching of Jesus than any of His 12 disciples. And then there is a woman who will worship Jesus without saying a word. Most of what people do in this life is quickly forgotten by subsequent generations. But in Mark's gospel, there is a woman who is mentioned whose worship of Jesus is so extravagant that Jesus says of her that it would be spoken in memory of her forever. She is a woman who in the presence of Christ is so overwhelmed with the wonder of who He is, so amazed by the thought of all He had done for her, that she does something that many don't just fail to understand, but even those who were present labeled to be a foolish and frivolous waste. I hope your Bibles are open. Mark chapter 14. Let's start our reading in verse 1 and go down through verse 11. Mark records, "Now the Passover and unleavened bread were 2 days away, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to seize him by stealth and kill him. For they were saying, not during the festival, otherwise there might be a riot of the people. While he was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper and reclining at the table, there came a woman with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume of pure nard, and she broke the vial and poured it over his head. But some were indignantly remarking to one another, 'Why has this perfume been wasted? For this perfume might have been sold for over 300 denarii and the money given to the poor.' And they were scolding her. But Jesus said, 'Let her alone. Why do you bother her? For she has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you wish, you can do good to them. But you do not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for the burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her.' Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. They were glad when they heard this and promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him at an opportune time." And let's start, first of all, by establishing the setting, if you will. The events that we read here take place during Jesus' final trip to the city of Jerusalem. It is the days leading up to the Passover. And Jesus has arrived either on the previous Friday or Saturday, and he comes to a small village known as Bethany, a couple of miles outside of Jerusalem. And it is there during the Feast of Passover that Jesus would spend his nights, while during the day he would travel into the city of Jerusalem, and then at night he would travel back to spend the night at Bethany. Because of the large number of pilgrims who came to celebrate the feast, some suggest up to 2 million people came into the city of Jerusalem. The sounds and the smells of a mass of people and animals would fill the city. Most of those pilgrims slept either in tents or on the rooftops, or sometimes they were housed in the towns and villages of the surrounding countryside. And that is the case with Jesus, who many believe stayed in Bethany at the home of his friends Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And as the chapter opens, Mark tells us that the Passover feast is now 2 days away, probably on our Tuesday evening, what would have been their Wednesday. And they have gathered to begin to think about the celebration of their liberation from Egyptian bondage. At the days of the Passover, when those who were the firstborn in Egypt died, with the only exception being those homes that had the blood painted on their doorposts and lintels. And therefore, the pilgrims arrived in Jerusalem with a nationalistic fervor. They came with their hopeful expectations that the Messiah would come and would similarly deliver Israel from now the foreign oppression, not of the Egyptians, but the Romans. And because of the increased tensions, the Roman governor typically during this time moved from his headquarters in Caesarea along the Mediterranean coast to the fortress Antonia just outside the temple structure in the city of Jerusalem. And he would from there monitor the potentially volatile mobs who gathered during this time in the Jewish capital. But Mark tells us that not only were the Romans nervous, but so were the Jewish leaders. That they have been agitated by Jesus' actions for a long time, but now especially during this week as he is garnering the accolades from the crowds. Ever since Lazarus had been raised from the dead 3 months earlier from this point, they had been planning on Jesus' demise. And now in verses 1 and 2, we find that they look to make good on their determined effort to do away with this man who threatened not only in their minds their temple, but certainly their authority and their position. In recent days, their confrontation with Jesus had not gone well. Each engagement with Jesus led to simply another embarrassing defeat, while at the same time his popularity with the multitudes continued to soar.
It became clear in their minds that they are losing control of the situation, and this same Jesus demonstrates absolutely no interest in accommodation or compromise. And so he must die. But the timing couldn't be worse, because with the approach of the Passover, the nationalistic zeal of the masses had them hoping for and searching for a deliverer, and the city of Jerusalem is filled with rumors about this Jesus. And so they make their plans to arrest Jesus, to take His life, and yet they are talking about avoiding doing it during the feast. They can ill afford to face the wrath of the crowds and a riot break out among the masses. And so in their minds, Passover time is the worst possible time to take direct action against Jesus. Remember that just a couple of days earlier, He had entered the city of Jerusalem to the shouts of the crowd, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And the crowds put their garments and they put the palm branches on the ground before Him as He entered the city of Jerusalem. So they say, not during this time. And yet the very thing that they were looking to avoid is going to be exactly the thing that happens. Jesus is going to be arrested. He is going to be tried. He is going to be crucified during the feast of the Passover, because God is the one who's in control of the events, not the religious leaders. These men who think they are occupying such places of power are really little more than pawns in the purposes of God. They're not the ones who ultimately determine the timetable by which this thing occurs. God is. And as a result of that, the Passover will be transformed in the minds of those who are followers of Jesus, no longer reminding us first and foremost of God striking down the firstborn in Egypt, but instead what we have gathered to do this morning, and that is to remember God striking down His own firstborn to deliver men from sin. And then we find at the end of this text news of an extraordinary malice on the part of one of Jesus' own disciples. In verses 10 and 11, we're told that while the temple hierarchy is planning to seize Jesus, here we find that Judas is plotting to betray Jesus, and he goes to the chief priests who offer him money to do so. And in between the religious leaders in verses 1 and 2 and the account of Judas and his betrayal of Jesus, or at least the beginning of it in verses 10 and 11, Mark provides us with what really is a flashback to the previous Saturday when Jesus was in Bethany. It is John, and only John, who provides us with the precise chronology here, telling us that Jesus came to Simon's home 6 days before the Passover in John chapter 12 and verse 1. And so what Mark does is he intentionally sandwiches this extravagant worship on the part of Mary between the plots of death, or Jesus' death by the priests on one side, and the planning of Judas' betrayal on the other side. And that was a very common practice in both Matthew and Mark. The extravagant devotion of Mary thus stands in stark contrast to the evil hatred of the religious leaders on one side of it and the cruel disloyalty of Judas on the other side. And by the way, understand that with the exception of the hypocritical kiss that comes from Judas, during this time Jesus receives no other expression of love from anyone else leading up to His crucifixion other than Mary. In spite of the hatred demonstrated by others, we are told of a woman who loves her Lord so deeply that she cannot help but express that love in a remarkable manner. And then there's one other element in regard to the setting that we need to consider, and that is that all of this transpires in the home of a leper. Mark gives us no detail about who Simon is, how Jesus came to know him, or even to be in his house this evening. Obviously, Simon is a healed leper because lepers weren't allowed to live in towns. They weren't allowed to be in close proximity to non-lepers. More than likely, he is one of the many lepers that Jesus had healed over the course of his ministry. And it's interesting that he is not referred to as Simon the cured or Simon the cleansed, but Simon the leper. And I think Mark adds that in there to remind us that Jesus, even up to the as we approach His impending death, He continued to identify with the outcasts and those who were the former outcasts. Now, some go as far as to say that this Simon was a friend of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Tradition actually suggests that he was a relative, perhaps even their father. And John, in his account, informs us that all three of them were there, that is, Mary and Martha and Lazarus, that the 12 were present as well, and perhaps some others were gathered here in the home of Simon. And rather than telling us any of that, Mark simply is interested on what happens in Simon's home. And by the way, John is the one who identifies this woman as Mary. Who enters the company of men and she breaks an expensive jar of even more expensive perfume on Jesus' head. And it is there, beginning in verse 3 and going down through verse 9, that we see this extravagant worship that is provided by Mary to Jesus. And from it, hopefully, we learn something about extravagant worship. 3 points, and then we'll wrap up our study this morning. First of all, extravagant worship gives no thought to cost. Mark tells us that when Mary came, she brought with her an alabaster vial. It would have been a very elegantly shaped vial, a very fragile flask. It would have had a long and narrow neck, which would allow the contents within it to be slowly dispensed in terms of drops. And it was likely carved out of a translucent variety of either onyx or marble. But we're not just told about an expensive container, we're also told about its expensive contents. There was an aromatic oil that was imported from India and the Far East. It was a costly luxury that was sold throughout the Roman Empire. John chapter 12 and verse 3 tells us that it was about a pound, and that is a Roman pound, so about 11 or 12 ounces of pure nard. Its contents are undiluted. In our terms today of cologne or perfume, we would say it was 100 strength, I suppose. And the price of the contents, not including the vial itself, in verse 5 is placed at about 300 or perhaps greater than 300 denarii. That was the equivalent of an entire year's wage for the common laborer or the soldier. We would put it somewhere in the neighborhood of about $15,000 today. Most people would have saved years of their life to make that purchase, and it was typically used in preparation for their own funeral. According to Mark chapter 6 and verse 37, when Jesus fed the 5,000, and they were 5,000 men, and so it may have been 10 to 15,000 people, the disciples estimate the cost of about 200 denarii to give every single one of them a small portion of bread. And therefore, this image of giving to the poor, you can see that. How many people could that have fed? 200 could have fed 15,000. How much could 300 have fed? But what I want you to notice is where Mark goes, first of all, and that is that he focuses on the extent to which she goes. She actually breaks the vial. There is no intention on her part of saving some of this nard for later. She is going to use every single drop of it until the contents of that vial are completely exhausted. She doesn't apply it drop by drop. She breaks the vial and she pours the oil onto Jesus' head. John adds that she pours it onto Jesus' feet as well. She uses the entirety of the $15,000 worth of perfume in just a matter of minutes. And John, in his account, adds that the house was filled with the fragrance. I think you can understand that, can't you? A few squirts of perfume and the smell fills several rooms. Imagine breaking the entire bottle. This was lavish love. This was a profound sacrificial demonstration of affection and worship. Mary gave out of her deep love for Jesus, and she would use every drop for Him, every drop to honor Him, every drop to reverence Him. And according to John's gospel, Mary used the only towel that she had available, her hair, which she took down and she used to wipe the excess even from His feet. That in self-giving humility, she demonstrates that there is no sacrifice that is too costly, no service too demeaning. And we ought to learn from her that when we gather here on a Sunday morning, that we had better not gather simply to be seen of men. That our gathering here should not be for any kind of personal gain. Shouldn't be out of any sense of guilt or obligation. that we need to be here for the purpose of breaking our vials and pouring out to God all that we have. There was a man who had been out of town on business for an extended period of time, and he thought how nice it would be if he brought his wife a gift when he came home. And so he went to the department store and he walked up the perfume counter, and the first bottle that the clerk showed him cost $75. And he said, "Well, that's a little bit too much. Do you have something else?" So she showed him a bottle that cost $50. And he said, "That's still a little bit too expensive." Growing impatient, the clerk showed him a bottle that was priced at $15. And the man said, "You know, what I mean is something really cheap. I want to see something really cheap." And so she reached down behind the counter and she handed him a mirror. Mary's not looking to give as little as she can. That when she worships her God, she's not looking to give just as a little amount in order to just get by. In 2 Samuel chapter 24, we learn this, much the same thing from David, who, as the pestilence that had come as a result of his numbering the Israelite army, comes upon Israel, that David repents and he understands his sin and he is instructed to offer a sacrifice. And he goes to the threshing floor of a man by the name of Araunah. And there he looks to purchase that, not just the threshing floor, but everything that would be necessary to offering the sacrifice. And Araunah, because it is the king, says, "I'll just give it to you. You can have it." And David responds in verse 24 by this marvelous saying, I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." Christianity is expensive. It was William Barclay who said that love does not neatly calculate the less or the more. It is not concerned to see how little it can decently give. If it gave all it had, if indeed it gave all the world, the gift would still be too little. Now, Mark doesn't tell us the specifics of what was going on in the mind of Mary, but he does tell us what's going on in the minds of those who witness this act of devotion. And it leads us to the second element of extravagant worship, and that is that it gives no thought to the critics. And the response on the part of the disciples is a bit surprising, then again, maybe not. Here is Mary filling the room with the evidence of her love and devotion for Jesus, and at the same time she faces the harsh criticism of those who are focused on the foolish economics of what she has just done. I like what I came across this saying, for every action there is an equal and opposite criticism. That's true, isn't it? Mark tells us that some of them became indignant. They were complaining about the waste of something so costly. And they went so far in verse 5 to scold her, a word in the Greek that meant to snort or to roar. It was often used to describe the actions of horses. Now, to their credit, they express a concern for the poor. And that wasn't something that was new. God's care for the poor had been evident throughout the law of Moses. It was equally plain during the days of Jesus' ministry. Jesus spent the overwhelming bulk of his time not in the wealthier area of Judea, but in the much poorer region of Galilee. He shared much of his time with peasant farmers and fishermen and craftsmen who lived either near or at the bottom of their local economies. He came to serve the least. And so, in a sense, these men are to be commended that they recognize that aspect. They have paid attention to that part of their teacher. But again, going to John's account, this time in verse 4, it reveals that Judas is the initial instigator of this criticism. And he offers this protest that sounds so good, so spiritual. It contains just enough truth and logic to convince others in the room to join with him in the criticism. And yet John adds that while the other disciples, their motive is one of stewardship, that foremost in the mind of Judas is greed. He feels personally cheated by this senseless act, because had this perfume been sold as it has been suggested, it would have never made it to the poor, because John tells us that the group's treasurer, Judas, was a thief. And it's interesting here that Judas sees 300 denarii as too much to spend on the worship of Jesus, but he will accept much less than that in exchange for the life of Jesus. Sadly, Judas's greed
passes for compassionate concern for the needy. While at the same time, Mary's generous act of worship is judged to be an impulsive, frivolous waste of resources. Now, they're only speaking among themselves, and yet Jesus is fully aware of the topic of their conversation, and he knows that the innuendo that was initiated by Judas has implicated him as well. Lenski, in his commentary, puts it this way. He said he condemns not only Mary, but Jesus himself. Judas implies that Jesus is robbing the poor, that he is lavishing upon himself what rightfully belonged to charity, that for his own glorification he allows a waste that is utterly wrong, that his example is harmful to others, and that Judas is the man who knows what is right, proper, charitable, and is not afraid to mention it. And so Jesus here is put in a very difficult position. As appearing to condone waste merely by his acceptance of what Mary does, and yet in his response, he brilliantly defends Mary's actions while at the same time supporting the basic truth in regard to the wise use of material resources. Though their plea for the poor is well grounded, their protest demonstrates a lack of awareness in regard to the uniqueness of this occasion. The monumental point that they are within the history of their own nation. Jesus declares here that being in harmony with God and His will and His timing is more important than caring for the poor. Caring for the poor is important. We see that throughout Scripture. But it must never be allowed to be the most dominant factor in Christianity. And sadly, there are many churches that are making that mistake. That they become far more philanthropic organizations that tend to the needs of people physically rather than being spiritual treasuries where God's Word and the Gospel can be dispensed with an evangelistic fervor. They didn't know it, and maybe Mary didn't either. But she was encouraging Jesus during what was a very difficult final phase of His mission. And Jesus' point to them is you wouldn't think that it was bad stewardship. You wouldn't think of it as a useless waste if she spent that money on somebody's embalming. Jesus acknowledges that they will always have the poor with them, but these men only have a few more days to express their devotion to Him while He is physically present with them. Soon that privilege is going to be gone forever. And yet here is Mary, who is not supposed to know anything, and yet she is the one who anoints God's anointed. And by the way, don't miss the fact here that it is not a priest, it is not an authorized prophet who anoints God's king, it is a woman. And don't miss the fact of where it takes place, not in a palace, not in a temple, but in the home of a leper. This king is not like any other king. Wittingly or unwittingly, her actions were in harmony with Jesus' repeated predictions about His own immediate future. She's prepared Him for burial, He says. And then the third and final point is that it gives no thought to compensation. Mary expressed her worship to Jesus in this way without any thought of recognition or reward or return. She wasn't looking for the spotlight. She wasn't hoping here to win the applause of the crowds, to receive some kind of payback. She's simply giving all of her heart to Jesus in an expression of totally selfless generosity. And in that, she stands very different from the 12 who are continually wanting to be deemed the greatest in the kingdom. Even this very night, they're having that discussion among themselves. Who's going to sit on the right? Who's going to sit on the left in Jesus' kingdom? They're constantly worried about the rewards of glory and power that Jesus could give to them. And yet Mary enters the home of Simon, and she is only focused on what she herself can give to Jesus. I love Jesus' statement there in verse 8. She has done what she could. God, whether it's in worship or in life, never asks us to do more than what we can do. But He does expect us to do all that we can. And that was exactly what Mary chose to do. What it shows us is that God doesn't compare us with other people. He doesn't say she's done what somebody else could do. She did what she could.
That God doesn't compare us with others, He compares us with ourselves. What are we capable of doing? And then in verse 9, in response, we find the only time that Jesus ever raised a monument to a specific human being. And this eternal memorial is not a bottle of perfume, but it is the genuine faith of a woman who acted while the chance to love and honor and serve Christ was available to her. And in all of this morbid talk of death, Jesus utters an amazing prediction that could only be explained by the resurrection, that wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her. He's not going to be some localized Messiah who's only concerned about a single nation. The good news, He said, is going to be preached to the entire world. And what Jesus says in verse 9 is true, isn't it? Because here we are some 2,000 years later, studying Mary's unselfish act of love, her lavish demonstration of devotion, her extravagant expression of worship. And as we hopefully not just learn from Mary, but we learn from Mary that we are compelled in worship to be less logical and more generous, less analytical, more compassionate, less self-centered, more Christ-centered, less concerned with what others think and more concerned with what God thinks in honoring His Son. And against the backdrop of the ugliness of His enemies' hatred and the evil of the betrayer stands the incredible beauty of Mary's adoration that seizes the opportunity to sacrifice this precious gift to Jesus. And Jesus says that her act of extravagant worship will never be forgotten. This morning we've remembered it. But Jesus meant more than that. Mark records it so we will learn from it as well.